Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, a Northwest neighborhood says putting a new morgue in the predominantly Black community is modern-day redlining. We'll discuss the lawsuit residents have filed in protest. Later in the program, Lift Every Voice and Sing Park is finally on the verge of opening. The project's most vocal champion joins us with a preview. But first, residents of the city's Brentwood neighborhood say construction on a new medical examiner's office reveals stark racial differences in how different communities are treated. To talk about it, I'm joined by Metro Gardens Neighborhood Association President, Lydia Bell. Welcome back, Lydia.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by her attorney, Neil Henriksen. Welcome, Neil.
Morning, Ann.
So last week, 18 residents filed suit against the city of Jacksonville for building a 51,000 square foot medical examiner's office in their neighborhood. The building is currently under construction. It's actually pretty well underway. Lydia, why file suit now? What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, we had to file suit because we could not stop it. We wanted to stop it, but because they broke so many city ordinances that we couldn't stop it. So therefore, like I said earlier, if I could have stopped it, I would have drove all those bulldozers into the St. John's River, because the manner in which they came into our neighborhood, no planning hearing, no knowledge, that we were out there fighting against a drive-through liquor store. So if we're driving against the drive-through liquor store to save our children from drunk drivers or pedophiles, our motto was no bottle and a child. But now it's no book and a morgue, because the morgue is being replacing the liquor store.
Remind us a little bit, because I think the last time you were in was when that liquor store issue was still pending.
Yes.
That's actually right next door to this building site.
Yes. We heard a rumor in April of 2023, that's when we heard the rumor while we were picketing the drive-through liquor store, that a morgue was coming out there, the new forensic science, a morgue and a forensic science lab. So it was like, where are they going to put a morgue? Come to find out, April, they got the funding. May 15, they had the groundbreaking ceremony, and they started building the morgue behind the liquor store. So now we're fighting, at that time, we were fighting the drive-through liquor store and a morgue across the street from a school, 32 feet to be exact.
32 feet. And mm-hmm. Neil, tell us about why a lawsuit in this case. The neighborhood residents, and we can talk about the success they had with the liquor store, but they did have some success fighting that. Why is litigation helpful or necessary?
Sure. Well, in March of 2024, that's when the final exception to the zoning, the community actually had the Planning Commission of the city reject the exception that the city was seeking.
Why did they need an exception for the building?
Because this is a 51,000 square foot facility, and when they got the zoning changed, although the zoning requests for change were occurring while construction was ongoing, they needed another 11,000 square feet because they only had 40,000 square feet as required and allowed by the ordinance code.
So to be clear, they had to get a zoning change, but then they still needed an exception to the zoning that they received.
That's correct. And then in March of 2024, this year, that was approved by a committee of the city council. And so all those pieces were then in place. And this really, it was a situation where the construction had been ongoing and couldn't be stopped. And if the community sought to stop it and by chance got an injunction, they would have to put up a bond for millions and millions of dollars. So the claims here involve, one, special damages to the residents who live adjacent to and right near the community center, enjoyment of their property, the value of their property, the saleability.
When
of
you say
property.
The community center.
No, the community, the people who live, the residents who live right there,
okay,
would not enjoy the same attributes that any other real property holder in the city would have. Enjoyment of their property, saleability, the value of their property, because they abut and they live right next to a 300-body morgue.
Remind us what happened because it wasn't universal approval at those various stages. When they were seeking a rezoning, when they were seeking the exception, there was some pushback from, for instance, the staff or the planning commission.
Right. So this, after the fact, so the Curry administration had put this property as the location at the, I guess it was in May or April of 2023. Groundbreaking takes place May of 2023. No approvals for the rezoning from commercial to public had been approved, but the work commenced, the site work commenced on the property. That was something, and Lydia could speak to this, the community had then recently found out about and started raising with council members and with staff. At that point, the process of approving the rezoning to public from commercial was taking place, and there was pushback. And in fact, a hearing that was supposed to take place with the Planning Commission was postponed into December of 2023, and that's where this exception, the rezoning was approved. The rezoning was approved in September of 2023 from commercial to public, but then in December, the exception to add this additional 11,000 square feet to allow the project to go forward was rejected by the Planning Commission. That then needed to be, the city then chose to appeal that to a city council committee that acted almost like an appellate body, and it was at that appellate body by the city council reversed. And that's what leaves the community in this predicament. But really, it's here you had work commencing before any of these approvals took place.
Lydia, it's my understanding, I've heard you speak on this a couple of times, that this project, although it was, that it's being built now and it broke ground last year, that it's actually been a project that dates back to 2016. And in that period of time, up until the groundbreaking, there were 38 sites that were explored.
They said 38 sites. So when we demanded to see the list, they gave us a list of only 26. But you have Reverend Ted Corley and Lynn Corley, who took the time to do two wonderful books of Brentwood area. And they took the time to visit each of those sites. Two of them were railroad tracks. Two were not even on the appraisal list. And the rest were light and industrial areas. Where it's at now on Davis Street in a neighborhood, it wasn't even on the list. So we wanted to know, how did it end up in a little tiny neighborhood that wasn't on the list? And the mere fact that they were looking at light and industrial areas, that's where it should be, not in a neighborhood, not across from school children. Then we had Dr. Salikia Nesbitt, who spoke at our press conference, that was talking about the environmental impact study. She has asked them to do that. We have nothing, even for a traffic survey. Had they done that, because it's just one little block. That's where the parents pick up children, buses pick up and deliver children, let them go to school. All of that activity is one little tiny block. They have given us no studies of any kind. They just came over there and started building in April. May.
One of the key contentions of this lawsuit and also of the community is that it didn't receive the notification that it should have. And in so far as that the city violated what's known as the Neighborhood Bill of Rights.
Yes.
Remind us what that Bill of Rights promises to communities like Magnolia Gardens and like Brentwood.
Well, in the Neighborhood Bill of Rights, it states that the community should be informed of any rezoning or anything coming into your community, so you would have a active participation of saying how you feel what should be in your community. If I can understand why they did not have a planning hearing, because I don't think it's anyone in their right mind or their wrong mind that would say, yes, I think that's a wonderful thing to have a 300-body morgue in your neighborhood when you would be transporting all the dead bodies from Clay County, Baker County, Nassau County. Who want to pass a morgue every day? Who want their children going past a morgue every day? The morgue is so close, the children can look out the window and see the activities of all that traffic bringing bodies in and out, and then the forensic lab that they speak of, where people would be coming from all over the world to study. I have a problem with that because of COVID, all these diseases, they got an outbreak of measles. Who need that 32 feet from a school or someone's neighborhood? The morgue is 3 feet from someone's home.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about a lawsuit challenging the city morgue that's already under construction on the city's northwest side. You can join our conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. We have a call. Good morning, Stanley. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Yes, good morning to everybody. Yes, what we have here is a federal lawsuit. This is not a local situation because we already know the history of Jacksonville. First question that I have is, why would anybody put a mall in a neighborhood? It has to be about money because where the property is located. So my main concern here, this is a federal lawsuit, number one. Number two is, who in the right mind would make that decision? I'm talking about in city council. And where is the city council person for that area? I haven't heard nothing. And I do research. Thank you.
Thank you, Stanley. Go ahead,
Lydia. The city council person is Jacoby Pittman, who has voted against us, who has lied on us. So we don't have that type of support or representation. But we represent ourselves. We keep going forward. We didn't know anything about the liquor store. We didn't know anything about the morgue. But what we do, we keep going forward. And then I have a problem with, because it is the Land Use and Zoning Commission that's made up of 7 council people, you couldn't find 4 of those people, because it's majority rule, you couldn't find 4 of those people to say this is inappropriate, since their job is to oversee zoning and oversee things that's coming into the community to make appropriate decisions. No one could say that a morgue in a neighborhood by a school is inappropriate, and then you take it before the city council for them to approve it. You have 19 city council members. We couldn't get 10 members to say this is wrong. So when you got a governing body like this, then there is something erratically wrong when you got all these elected officials that we're paying money to and nobody says this is wrong.
Do we get any sense as to whether it's at the planning stage or at the city council stage, whether city council members are asking, was the neighborhood notified?
I think this is a circumstance where you had the Curry administration had put in place a project, perhaps thinking, hey, the path of least resistance, maybe the community would do nothing about it, right at the tail end of the administration in 2023, and that you have council members who might be thinking, well, they've already started work. There's millions of dollars being spent, and perhaps they're thinking it's not something that will have a negative, it'll have a negative economic impact. And so here you have a circumstance where a prior administration comes in, puts in place a plan that's, this is over a $60 million project. And I don't think the community is saying there shouldn't be at some location, appropriate location, a new morgue and a new medical examiner's office. It's in the, it's really hidden away on Jefferson Street currently and way too small. Mm-hmm. But they had work commenced before the proper rezoning. And so you have this community paying the price, and thank goodness you have community activists who had become aware of it and then paid attention and have now been advocating about it. But their advocating has led to, even though the Planning Commission rejected the additional exception, to having to bring a lawsuit about their damages. And as we can speak of about the Neighborhood Bill of Rights, which has a very important provisions about transparency in our city's government.
And then I would like to add that even if it was the previous mayor, Lenny Curry's administration, who did it, and then this now administration just saying, okay, we're going to let it go, you got to understand it's in the Black community. It would never be Lenny Curry's administration or this administration. No one would ever put a morgue in a white neighborhood. It's very insensitive to what we want in our neighborhood. And then just the mere fact, as I said, about when we had our very first meeting since 2016 of the planning was September 18, 2023. And it was passed out that Mayor Deegan, her administration was saying that already $4 million have been paid. And if it's if they pull the plug, it's going to delay them 5 years and $10 million more. Like I said, they had $25 million they found from in the budget of COVID. They went out and looked at other organizations to give that money to. If they were about doing the right thing, like we were saying, remove it. We're not against the morgue being built. We just don't want it in our neighborhood. It's inappropriate there.
We've got some calls coming in. I want to go to Shamari in West Jacksonville. Good morning, Shamari. Go ahead.
Good morning. Good morning. So when I first heard about this, was on this program, I guess, the first time you got here. And so, and I do have two things. This one here, when I heard about this, I went downtown immediately that same day. And I went to meet with two councilmen that I had access to. And I asked, well, what's going on with this? You know, how is this happening? And they were, it was an African-American, the primary was an African-American councilman. And he said, well, it's too late for anybody to do anything because this train has left the station because when the notices went out, no one responded. So that's number one is I understand what the plaintiff is saying here. And I'm from this community, but at the same time, what happens when the notices go out and people aren't paying attention? Then who's responsible?
Shamari, I'm going to leave it there for now, just because your cell connection is pretty poor. Lydia,
there was no notices that went out. And here's the thing: that's why I like to deal with facts instead of hearsay. You know, a lot of people hear things, but they're not hearing the truth. We never had a planning hearing. There was no notices that went out. And then the city hid behind. If we sent out a notice and you didn't receive it, then they're not responsible. Well, you're the paid employee. We don't mail notices to ourselves. That's what we're paying you for. If you said you sent out a notice, as I was saying in the liquor store, prove it. You saying it's in part of you put it in the financial paper, you put it in the daily quotes, it's posted down at City Hall. Is it mandatory that we read these newspapers? And then you say you mailed it to us. We didn't get it. You got us on a mailing list, but we never received. That's your job to make sure we received it. I'm not working for you. You're working for me.
We also have a call from Eugene on the north side. Good morning, Eugene. Go ahead.
Good morning to the panel and staff. I got a quick question regarding this, or comment rather, regarding this issue and all of the issues all around the town. Are our elected council people, are they AI? Or can I go back in time and say, are they live or numerix? Because it seemed like they're so insensitive. I don't know if these are human beings making these decisions or if it's a computerized concept.
Thanks, Eugene. Appreciate your comments. We also have an email I'd like to get to from William. He says, from the outside, the morgue will appear like any other typical office building. There are more dead and dying people in our hospitals than a morgue. Neil, what do you say to that?
Well, you know, there's one thing when we were looking at the lawsuit, there's studies that show that having a morgue in a community by almost 20% devalues the properties of the people there. Now, I think that's one aspect of it, and that's part of what we have the ability to bring suit about, the special damages. But there's also, and I think the residents, like Lydia, can talk to this, the psychological effect. Right now, the morgue is on Jefferson Street, right off 8th, in the middle of all other offices and the medical complex. It's not prominent in the community.
It's here, right behind UF Health.
That's correct. And here, situated right crime in the community, next to a school, next abutting homes, residents where people bring their grandchildren and have families, is a 300 body morgue.
Yeah. 300 bodies over and over and over again on a little tiny street. See, it's more to it than just the morgue being there. There's a tiny street that they can't even get through. It's disrupting everything in our community.
See, go ahead, Lydia.
Jacksonville is too large. The largest city is about a square mile. They could have put it anywhere. No one is against the morgue. We're against that. It does not fit in our community.
So there was a community protest last week at City Hall announcing this lawsuit. At that event, Brentwood resident and plaintiff Amina Sharif spoke. Let's take a listen.
You're not doing it in the white neighborhood. This would not even be considered if it even came up as a conversation. But when you're talking about a black neighborhood, oh, well, it don't matter. They won't do nothing. Those days are over.
We also have a message from Mark on Facebook. He says, is there any comparable project that has happened in other parts of town? This is the only medical examiner's office in this judicial circuit. Is that
right? That's correct. And this covers multiple counties. And, mm-hmm. and this is the main project. Interestingly, years ago, and I was involved with some of this on the legal end, the supervisor of elections office moved out of Gateway, which is in the community generally. And one of the reasons was so it could be in an industrial area. So here you had voting that was moved out, the central voting location.
Out of the Gateway Mall.
Out of the Gateway Mall to Imeson, an industrial area. And it was seen as facilitating the function of the office, but also, taking it out of a community. Here, we're putting in a morgue for a community that is, this is a new school. The Kipp School is a beautiful looking school. You have people who have been trying to improve their community and their neighborhood, and this is being taken away from them.
Yes. I want to take a call from Tabitha in Jacksonville. Good morning, Tabitha. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Lydia. Hi. Neil.
Hi, Tabitha.
I'm listening this morning. I'm actually one of the plaintiffs in the suit. I just wanted to respond to one of the callers that called just a second ago about the notices being sent out. The thing about that was, I don't remember the caller's name, but the construction started before the rezoning. So even if notices had been sent out, they were irrelevant at that point because the city had steamrolled and already started the construction. And I also wanted to bring up the racial inequities here, that the same thing happened in Fort Lauderdale, that the city went in and tried to put 150,000 square foot morgue in a historically black neighborhood beside of school. And in that situation, the city actually went to the neighborhood properly ahead of time and gave them an opportunity to voice their concerns, and the neighborhood won. And I feel that if the same courtesies had been extended to this neighborhood, it's not even courtesies, it's our rights. And no one in Jacksonville should be okay with the city coming in and knocking down trees and building a publicly taxpayer-funded building 3 feet from your driveway. And if we're being honest with ourselves, no one would like that. So I just want to say that I am proud to stand with Lydia, with Metro Gardens, and I'm very thankful that Neil decided to take on our case.
Thanks, Tabitha. There is this question, Lydia, as to the way that this project went forward, the fact that there was so much investment made, and the city has said millions of dollars of investment made before the process was complete, and then kind of now saying that because of that investment, it's too late to stop.
Well, just like the liquor store, when people say they paid out $1.8 million to someone who paid only $150,000 for the building, when you do the right thing, you don't have to pay out $1.8 million. When you do...
I was just going to say, so people who aren't familiar with that project, somebody did buy that property, they built the liquor store, the drive-through liquor store, and then the city went ahead in response to community pressure and bought that for $1.8 million.
Right, because the ordinance says it has to be 500 feet away from a school or church, and it was only 32 feet from the church. And then you have the liquor store. Now you come with the morgue. We out there fighting against the morgue. For anyone who questioned whether we receive notices, do you think we would rather be out in 95 degree? We are 70 years old. We're an old group of young of people who just want to live our life properly. Do you think if we had the choice to be at a planning hearing to voice our opinion as opposed to finding out while they're building, because that's the same thing here. We find out about it while it's being built. The liquor store and the morgue. They have us running around like rats on a sinking ship. Other people get notices where they can voice their opinion, but we don't get those chances. If I had the chance to be at a planning hearing to voice my opinion, I certainly wouldn't be out in 95 degree weather all summer long fighting a liquor store just to find out a morgue is coming into our area the same way.
We have a call. I believe it's Roselle. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name's Roselle. Hi, Lydia. You know, these ladies and this community has really, really done the work. You know, they're very active. They're very well informed and educated. I've been on the picket lines with them. And I just want to say redlining, redlining, redlining. That's Jacksonville. Nothing changes if nothing changes. You know, supposedly if we know better, we do better. It's redlining, pure and simple, and it's really horrific. I mean, nobody proposed bringing it to my neighborhood in Avondale. I didn't get any, you know, no propositions on that. Right. That's all I have to say. Thank you for this program.
Thank you, Roselle.
Thanks so much. We also have a call from Eric in Arlington. Good morning, Eric. Go ahead. You there, Eric? We'll come back. We've got a call from Tom on the west side. Good morning, Tom. Go ahead.
Good morning to you, too. As we saw at the meeting on the city council's hearing on the collective, I mean, the community benefit agreement, they.
I think we just lost you there. Got a call from Dale. Good morning, Dale. And perhaps Tom can try us back.
Yes. Good morning. Good morning, Ms. Lydia.
Good morning.
I was just concerned, Ms. Lydia. I'm glad that you stated, you know, somewhat of your young age, first of all. and I know that you are a longtime member of that community.
Mm-hmm.
I myself am a member of the Eastside community. Yes. And we're having some difficulties over there as far as with the stadium and things of that nature. But I own a business in the Phoenix Avenue Arts District, which is right neighboring to the east side.
Mm-hmm.
And a little while back, a gentleman who owned a warehouse building across the street from my business, he passed away. His wife, his widow, was going to sell that building to a group of investors who were going to put a nightclub in there. Now, we did receive some notification, not from the city or anything, because it never got to that point. We received that information from the actual the guys that were going to purchase that building. We didn't want that in the neighborhood. It is a light industrial and residential neighborhood. It sits right off of Phoenix Avenue.
Mm.
So what we did was, you know, we got another group of people who needed a space. And they bought that building and they use it now as an artist studio. It's like lofts or something that they cut in there for different artists. And there's the guy who actually was the physical buyer of the building. He rents to the other artists, local artists, and some people from out of town. The reason why I say that is because for years, the property that you're talking about is in question, if I'm not mistaken. First of all, there was a hotel, a high-rise hotel on that building, on that site.
Holiday Inn.
Then that went into disrepair. It was, well, you know, at some point it became unstable and it was demolished. Now, I don't know how that was done. I would assume that it was done by the city.
Dale, I'm going to ask you just to wrap up real quickly. I've got a couple other calls I got to get to.
Okay, I'm sorry, but the point I'm trying to get to here is that we have to be better stewards of our neighborhoods. And when the probably sat over there, because I'm in that area a lot, uncut, unkept, for years. No one was making any complaints about this.
Well, see,
we have to be better stewards of our own neighborhoods.
Now,
thanks, Dale. I'm going to let Lydia respond.
Let me cut in on that. It was not uncut, unkept. There are trees. Trees are part of life. It gives oxygen to the neighborhood. Now, sure, there were some people using it as a trash area, but that had nothing to do with the environment, the trees. It was just not an unkept property. What's unkept now is when you come over there and bulldoze the entire area without our knowledge and leave one tree by the house.
I think Eric from Arlington has joined us again. Sorry about that, Eric. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I was just wondering, from your lawsuit, what are you trying to accomplish? Say, for instance, you win. Is that going to stop the building from being built? That would be my question. What are you trying to accomplish from the lawsuit? Thank you.
Good question. Just briefly, Neil.
Sure. The lawsuit is seeking special damages, that is, accountability for the enjoyment, the residents losing enjoyment of the property value, saleability, and more broadly for the city, a declaration from a court about the impact of the Neighborhood Bill of Rights passed in 1995, still on the city's website today, and whether that's really truly going to be complied with or not.
But this is not necessarily a request for an injunction.
That's correct.
Yes. And then you got to understand where our problem is, the process. If you do things right, then you don't have these problems like paying someone $1.8 million. In this case, the same thing, no planning hearing. And then when you go to the Laws, Use, and Zoning Commission and tell them these problems, no planning here, we didn't know anything about it, then they have a hearing and the medical examiner office staff, they don't even show up. They wanted to ask questions about, well, how did you all come to this location? What's going to be in the building? What are you going to do? How things are going? They weren't even there to answer it. And yet they still passed the approve the rezoning of it.
Well, Lydia Bell, thank you for coming back to talk to us about this. Please
thank
keep
you,
us current on this. And Neil Henriksen, thanks so much for coming on the program today.
Thank you, so much. And we'll be back.
Up next, a long-awaited La Villa Park honors two of Jacksonville's most famous residents. Welcome back. Listening to a little of that famous song, Lift Every Voice and Sing, a downtown park that's years in the making officially opens Thursday. Here to talk about it, as well as the long and arduous journey to get here, is the park's champion, Lloyd Washington. He's also the president of the Durkeyville Historical Society. Welcome, Lloyd.
Thank you.
Also joined by Mari Kshari, President Mari, help me.
Qureshi.
Mari Qureshi, president of the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You'd think I'd have that down by now. Lloyd, tell us about the roots of this project, if you will, as well as the story behind the name.
Behind the name? It was an argument.
It was an argument.
Yes, because originally I walked up to Councilman Jones and asked him, what would it take to name a park after John Roseman Johnson?
Brother of James Weldon.
Weldon Johnson. And he immediately asked, what about James Weldon? And I asked again, what does it take? And that started the journey. And it's been a learning process. because I'm learning there were no plans for La Villa, period. Once it was the Harlem of the South, to see that it's been torn down, there were no plans to for rebuilding at all. So when the DIA decided to redo La Villa, the park was not part of the plans. We were told that they did not come here to build a park. Economic development was the problem, was the charge.
So for folks who don't remember, River City Renaissance was a project of the Austin administration. It was in 1993. It basically raised all of La Villa, a residential neighborhood.
It basically leveled all of La Villa.
Mm-hmm.
It was, like I said, to see the demolition to what was the Harlem of the South was quite a low blow. Because you're talking about the end of the Chitlin' Circuit. You're talking about people like Ray Charles, James Brown's. All these major stars came to Jacksonville. And I've always questioned, are we talking about they left here and went to Harlem? Do we want to say that Harlem was the Jacksonville of the North?
I've heard that argument made. I mean, as you say, Billie Holiday, Dizzy Gillespie, so many greats came through and played in La Villa. So little left of that standing. But this park, Mari, is kind of an effort to rekindle some of the history. Remind us who James Weldon Johnson, John Roseman Johnson were, and their role in creating that song.
Of course. So James Weldon Johnson went on to become known for being the first African-American secretary of the NAACP and, you know, consul to Venezuela. He was an incredible Renaissance man, but he used to be a high school teacher. He used to be a high school teacher at Stanton High School in La Villa, and in 1900 composed the lyrics to Lift Every Voice and Sing in honor of Abraham Lincoln's birthday. And his brother put the words to music, and so Lift Every Voice and Sing is their joint product, and the park is going up where they were born and raised.
It's on the site of their home in La Villa.
That's right.
Yeah. So there's a lot of community place and culture there. Lloyd, what was it about James Weldon Johnson's brother that you were so intent on having something named for him and honoring him in particular?
I walked into the Dirkeville Historical Society one day. There was an award there in display case one, and it said J. Roseman Johnson was nominated to the Florida Artist Hall of Fame, and they had a series of his music and his accomplishment. And the first thing I wanted to know was, who was J. Roseman Johnson? Because most people don't know. And I was very fortunate that Dr. Carolyn Williams, who was the president of the Dirkeville Historical Society, was standing behind me, and I looked down at her because she was every bit of 5'2". And I looked down at her, and she started to smile, and she said, Google. And at that point, I went to the Yale Library, and I learned as much as I could about Roseman, and I became an avid fan of Roseman Johnson.
This park project for you, the grand opening is this Thursday, but this path started for you 17 years ago?
Yes.
Why has it taken so long? I mean, some people will remember, as I do, there was a marker there for many, many years, but it was just a grass field. There was a plaque with this Lift Every Voice and Sing lyrics on it.
The Dirkeville Historical Society, we were the reason that the plaques were there. Like I said, when I went to Councilman Jones, he became a friend, a person who was on my side.
This is Warren Jones.
Warren
now
Jones.
Now on the school board. Yeah.
Yeah, now on the school board. And we moved forward on it. And like I said, it sat there for years with just the three plaques there. But most people didn't realize, yes, it had the three plaques there, but it was also part of the Jaguar's park and ride. So we had to get a mark, something to block the area off. It was also the Soul Circus came in, and that was where all their elephants used to. So we had, we had to write a letter to the mayor and remind him that the value of this piece of property.
So this is now really a transformation. The architect or the parkitect that designed it is Walter Hood. He is a Genius Grant recipient. He lives in Oakland. He's also designed the African American Museum for Charleston. What do we know about this? What this project is will look like when the unveiling happens?
So Walter is, as you say, an amazing landscape designer, and he has designed the park to have a lifted lawn in homage to the words of the song, Lift Every Voice and Sing. There will be a musical stage that looks out on that lifted lawn. There will be a sculpture of the Johnson Brothers by Brian Lewis, an acclaimed African-American sculptor. And we just hope it'll celebrate the incredible creativity and vitality that used to exist in La Villa. And it's almost hard to imagine today because, as Lloyd said, all the buildings are gone.
Is there still an element of this that contains a recreated shotgun house?
So that's actually not a recreated shotgun house. It's a preserved shotgun house. There were three shotgun houses preserved in the La Villa neighborhood, and DIA held on to them. And when Walter saw one of those houses, he said, that house is actually one of the remnants of the built environment in La Villa. I want to try and use that as part of the design of the park. So it has become the musical stage.
And so this grand opening is Thursday. Lloyd, what are you looking forward to most?
Most? When we finally cut the ribbon, it's been a while. I must give the Jesse Balder Pond Fund a big shout out because we had gotten to a point where we didn't even know that we could go move any farther. And so when I met Maury, and she asked me a question, are you serious about this? And I said, yes, I'm very much so. So it moved forward from that point on.
Well, congratulations to you, Lloyd Washington. Maury, thank you so much for being here. We're going to have another little listen to this amazing version by Jada Holiday at Baylor University of Lift Every Voice and Sing, and we'll be right back.
Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at TerrellHogan.com.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at LifeSouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
A former IRS agent says the agency goes easy on wealthy people and corporations when investigating possible tax crimes.
You can bet if a billionaire files a complaint, it's completely different than if some average plumber files a complaint. I mean, it's ridiculous.
I'm Deborah Becker, inside the alleged class bias at the IRS. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times correspondent Peter Goodman illuminates the breakdown of the global supply chain during the pandemic. He says it was rooted in risky management practices, government deregulation, and corporate greed. His new book is How the World Ran Out of Everything. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
A failed border deal, rising numbers of asylum seekers, expanded protections for undocumented family members, and suggestions of mass deportations. Immigration is at the center of this presidential election. But the details of immigration policy get lost in the headlines. We look at what Donald Trump and Joe Biden would and could do on immigration in their second term. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. The Jacksonville Public Library is offering several programs for teens over the summer, including a few that don't actually require cracking a book. Here to tell us about it is Chris Boyven with the Jacksonville Public Library. Welcome back, Chris.
Hey, Ann. Thanks so much.
And Jay Brown, leader of the Noteworthy Band. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So the library isn't just about books anymore, Chris. Why is it important for libraries to branch out into other disciplines and other offerings?
Yeah, no, Anne, it's a great question. It is really important to for kids to and everybody to really find a way to engage with literacy in a lot of different ways. So, you know, literacy doesn't always just mean books. Books are very important and it's really our bread and butter. But it's a great opportunity to get, you know, when we can get people in the library, especially to interact with things like music and things like art so that they understand that this is a community space. It's a wonderful place for them to meet, to interact with others, to learn things, to have fun. And people understand that the library experience can be a really engaging and enlightening experience.
And particularly the downtown, the main branch, is really just an extraordinary building.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's the largest library building in Florida. And we have so much going on there all the time. I mean, Jay and his band have been there before to perform. And we have all kinds of things going on there at all the time. We have some special collections, some things that you might never see other places. We have a wonderful African-American history collection. And yeah, some really great Jacksonville things that you're only going to find at the main library.
Jay, how did you begin to engage with the library? Were you like a library nerd as a kid? Did you go, or was it something that you came to a little later in life?
My mother was the head of the children's department at Maine, so we were voluntold that we were going to participate in the summer program every year. So we spent a lot of time at the library growing up, me and my three sisters.
And your mom's a librarian, so she must have been encouraging you, I would guess, at the very least, to be
a reader. She had us reading and writing before we were literally in school.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
So mom was serious about it. Yeah.
Is she still working?
She passed about 5 years ago now.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah. Well, what a great legacy. And
absolutely.
So you now work with the library on a musical basis.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that.
So we have our Jazz It Up workshop that we do. It is a program where we teach jazz form and jazz drumming styles. So the last 2 years we did it more as a presentation where I would have a combo, I'll be on drums, we have a sax player, sometimes a vocalist, and we would perform the songs for the students so they would see what the solo section is, the intro, the section A, you know, the different breakdowns of the different sections and what do you do in each section. Like there's a solo section where we always say, look at me, that's where one person does their solo and everyone else falls back and listens. It's like a conversation. Mm. So if everyone's talking at the same time, you can't really understand what anyone is saying. So if you're soloing, you're the person who has the stage and everyone else just falls back and listens.
And how does that conversation happen so that you know it's your time to step forward for the solo?
Mainly understanding the basic jazz form. So you have the intro, which is hello, and then you have the melody or the head section, which is like the basic chorus, the refrain that you hear over and over and over again.
Go ahead. Oh. I'm sorry.
And that's our basic jazz form, where you have the opening, the melody, the solo section. We'll go back to the melody. Perhaps we'll have a long solo section, but then we always come back to the chorus and conclude. So we talk about the basic jazz form and the different sections and what do you do in those sections.
And so, but this is more participatory this year?
Yes. This year we have drums. We have bass drums, snare drums, cymbals, and we have different sections where the students will come up and be either on the bass drum, the snare drum, or the cymbal. And for instance, we'll have swing style jazz. So if you're on cymbal, you play ching, ching-a-ling, ching-a-ling, ching-a-ling. And bass is playing on that one. Boom, two, three, four. Boom, two, right? Snare is on the downbeat. One, two, three, four, one, two. So we work that style. And then after that style, we'll go to waltz. Or we'll go to some of the more Latin styles like bossa nova. Bossa nova beat. So we'll do a few different rhythms with the students, and they'll get a chance to actually play the rhythms instead of just listening to us play them.
So, Chris, is this one of those times when you don't have to be quiet in the library?
Yes, no. The library is not about being quiet anymore. We got quiet spaces if you need them, but we love it when people get in the library and get loud.
So tell us, if people want to participate in this jazz series or in the other programs, where do they get more information?
Yeah, just go to the library's website, jackspubliclibrary.org/summer. You're going to see everything, or jackspubliclibrary.org/live.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Thanks, Chris, for coming back. Jay Brown, thanks for the music lesson. That was terrific.
Thank you.
All right. And that's our program. We want to take a minute to remember our beloved colleague, Rich Connor, who passed away suddenly last week. Rich has been with WJCT for decades and was a friend and a mentor to everyone he worked with. Rich was a major force behind the look and the feel of First Coast Connect. Aside from his immense talent, he is remembered for his kind and selfless demeanor and his sense of humor. Thank you, Rich. You are deeply missed. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.